Hello, welcome to Vox Pop. It's 2 o'clock. It's Thursday, July 22nd. It's gardening today, and we welcome Fred Breglia of Landis Arboretum and Bob Graves of Fatigan's Nursery to answer your questions. Greg Ward was supposed to be here. Please adjust your racing card. He is a late scratch today. If you have a gardening question, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Yes, let's make that garden grow. If you have an email, you can send it that way, too. VoxPop@WAMC.org, VoxPop@WAMC.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Fred and Bob and your gardening calls coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff, gardening today, and today we welcome back Bob Graves of Fatigan's Nursery and Fred Breglia of the Landis Arboretum, and we welcome your gardening calls right now. 800-348-2551 is our number, 800-348-2551, or email us. VoxPop@WAMC.org is the address. The number once again, though, is 800-348-2551. Bob Graves, welcome back to the show, sir.
It's very nice to be here in a beautiful sunny day when it's not raining.
Unbelievable the amount of rain. Fred, have you seen rain like this in your brief lifetime?
You know, I have, but it's been a while. I think this has got to be one of the wetter seasons that I've seen.
And this is not a hurricane. You know, usually when we get this kind of rain, it's a hurricane.
It is. It's just thunderstorms.
I remember, you know, 20 years ago, if you got 2 inches of rain, you thought, wow,
yeah,
that's a lot of
rain.
We
had five in a very brief.
Now it's five.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well,
yeah.
You know, and even on days when it hasn't rained, it has been so humid and jungle-like out there.
It must
be fun working outside, Bob. Are you regretting your career choices at this point?
Yeah, it changes from day to day, but it's terrible mud out there right now.
It's tough right now, you know, but we had a lot of dry years in there too, and honestly, for the trees and a lot of plants, the rain is probably doing more good than bad for the most part.
I think there's some vegetables and some of your squashes and pumpkins and stuff really don't like to be wet.
Not the best tomato weather. We usually do real good tomatoes, but we're working them this year to try to get them to harvest.
Well, Fred, I just want to thank you for bringing the magic mushrooms today, but we can't do that before the show. No, you brought a bag of something that looks like mushrooms. No,
These are our golden chanterelles.
Oh, my heavens.
They're a mycorrhizal mushroom. We talk a lot of times about mycorrhizae that benefits trees and symbiotic relationships with plants. And one of my favorite, I do a lot of talks, and I often urge people to create conditions that are favorable for mycorrhizae for plant growth. But I always like to say that I also even eat mycorrhizal mushrooms because they really are quite good, and you can't grow a lot of the mycorrhizal mushrooms, so you really
have to
wait for the right condition.
You have to be very knowledgeable to go out and collect these.
Though. Yeah.
You really do. You have to be 100% sure of what you're getting, and if there's any doubt, definitely don't touch it.
You gave a big bag to Ian Pickus, so you are 100% sure because we need them around.
I am. I feed them to my 6-year-old and my 11-year-old. They fight over the mushrooms. It's been, with one of the great things about this rainy season has been it has been an incredible fungi.
They seem to like it.
So you don't eat these raw. You cook them up.
You would want to cook those. Yeah, almost every mushroom you're pretty much going to want to cook. They don't take a lot of cooking. They're quick. You flash them up in a pan. I think a lot of people probably overcook them, but cook them through till they're hot inside, and that's really the done point. And you don't need much with them. They're sought after. They're a culinary gourmet.
Expensive. If you go to a restaurant, forget about it.
Exactly.
And we should have charged Ian, as a matter of fact.
It buys us some good faith, maybe in the future. In case
we'll see how long that gets you.
You're right.
All right. This is from Dan in Altamont. Dan writes, "I'm growing a variety of heirloom tomatoes in my garden this year. Several of the plants have yellowing leaves and spots. Some are turning black. I've been cutting off the bad leaves so the plants look a little barren, but the fruit itself looks okay so far. I'm afraid that I will defoliate the plants and tomatoes will just die on the vine. A friend said they thought it might be a fungus. In doing some research on garden fungi, I read that it can be very hard to get rid of. If it is a fungus, what should I do? Do I need to get rid of all of my raised bed garden soil and begin again, or is there a treatment?"
No, a lot of times it is like we just talked about sort of before the show or even a little bit during the beginning of the show, it's not been a great tomato season. And although that's great for a lot of mushrooms this rain, a lot of those funguses that attack plants, well, that it's also good for them, which means that they're going to have an easier time sort of wreaking havoc on your tomatoes.
Any kind of wet weather, whether it's rain or high humidity, tends to encourage fungus diseases. And sometimes the tomatoes will be fine.
Yep.
But they also don't like inconsistent water in the soil. They like to fairly even. They don't like to get wet and get dry. They don't like to get wet and get dry.
Right.
Just to culturally. But, you know, you can put an organic fungicide on them if you want, but it's really tough to fight it when you have this kind of weather.
Yeah, and once you've kind of got it at this point, it might be more of a losing battle than an actual win.
But you don't have
win.
To remove the soil. I mean, this stuff is in the air. You're never going to eliminate it in the future if we have this
like
kind of
weather.
Like the guy
said, you kind of cut off those leaves.
Yeah.
And, you know, just try to keep those plants growing. And, you know, I'm battling the same thing at home, and we're getting fruit.
Yeah.
But, you know, they look a lot worse. They looked a lot better last year.
Yeah.
Put it that way.
Yeah.
Potatoes are looking good, though.
Really?
Potatoes are going unbelievable potatoes.
Mm, that's good.
It
is the gardening show today with Fred Breglia, who is the director of the Landis Arboretum, Bob Graves, co-owner of Fatigan's Nursery, and the number to call is 800-348-2551. The email address, voxpop@wamc.org. Tell you what, let's go through the email bag a couple of times here, and then we'll take a quick break and then go to the phones. This one's from Maryland, and these emails came in early. This one says, I have blueberry bushes that are 10 years old. I have barely gotten any berries off of until this year when I finally put up bird netting. I had no idea birds were eating the berries before I could get to the ripe ones. Regardless of this, my berries have always been very tart. They are better now that I can protect them and let them ripen. However, they are still quite tart, do not taste as blue as the commercial ones from the store. What should I do to correct the taste so they're sweeter?
Mm. Well, one of the things you always want to check with blueberries is the pH of the soil. They need an acidic pH, something below 6, something in the 5.5, 5.7 range. Whether or not that's a problem with yours, you don't know, but you don't know until you check it. So I would certainly check that. You may want to fertilize them a little bit with an organic granular fertilizer. But you're right. If you don't put nets over blueberries, you don't get any because the birds will take them the instant they even look edible.
They really will. In most cases, they actually will take them as soon as they ripen up, too. So there are a few varieties now that that are out that are actually, they ripen off color.
A little pinkish, some of them are.
A little bit pinkish. It looks like, but they're totally ripe, but it fools the bird.
Fools the birds.
All right. This one is from Selena in beautiful northern Westchester County. Selena writes, the previous owner of my house planted large beds with daylilies. They look awful when they get brown leaves in late summer, beautiful for 2 weeks if the deer didn't eat them already, and boring all the other times of the year. Sorry for the daylily fans out there, if there are any. Any ideas for plants that go great with lilies that pick up the beds in between the 2 weeks of flowers? The picture below is off the patio from today, and it's a beautiful picture from Selena. Isn't that nice?
That
those daylilies look great.
They look gorgeous.
Yeah. You know, that's just the nature of perennials. They have their peak periods and then they deteriorate. And that's really what a perennial garden is you put different things in that bloom at different times. You know, this time of year, your coneflowers are fantastic.
They're looking good right now.
You need to find something that blooms a little later because the daylilies, I mean, that's just what they do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. One trick for lining out a perennial garden with bloom and you know, a lot of times just sketch it out on a piece of paper to rough dimensions and then roughly dimension the plants that are there, like those daylilies. And then you'll see all the spaces if you make your map, your little map, and then you just do an overlay, put a piece of tracing paper over it and fill in all those spaces for spring. Do another overlay summer, another overlay fall, and you've got your seasonal blooms, and you can even stagger the heights, and it works really well. I call them drifts.
That's a good
idea. Design that way. So you get your spring, summer, and fall.
Now, daylilies, this is the time of year?
It's a good time of year right now. Yeah, they're jamming. Yeah.
So they've been for weeks at this point.
Yeah, they've been going for a while. They're a great plant.
But they are, the daylily, the point is the flowers last a day.
if
you don't clean them off all the time, they get looking a little ratty.
Well, you know, here's the funny thing. We have some in the backyard.
Yep.
And I noticed these flowers. They say, oh, those are very nice. And what are they? Oh, they're daylilies, my wife says. And I said, oh, when did we get those? We've had them for 18 years.
Years.
Yeah. So this is what I do. It wasn't a Mets game, so I really wasn't paying attention.
There you go.
This email from John. Rose of Sharon. Why don't all the buds open? Thanks, John, in East Greenbush.
I'm assuming he's talking flower buds.
Yeah, on
the Rose of Sharon. Yeah?
Yeah. Rose of Sharon. Yeah, I mean, we have foliar buds and flower buds.
Oh, I see.
Doesn't say what he's talking about, but my gut feeling would be probably...
Sometimes the seed pods look like flowers that ought to open, too.
They do.
And they've already flowered. You didn't notice that that was gone, and you got a seed pod that looks a lot like a flower bud, but and they grow from seed. They'll just grow crazy.
Absolutely. So otherwise, if it's not that and the plant's losing vigor,
yeah.
Sometimes they'll choke themselves out with like a girdling root or strangling root system in general.
As we say all the time, if they're in too much shade, flowering plant doesn't flower well.
Yeah. So if you are losing it, then you might have another issue if you're losing stems. If it's just a few buds that he sees on there, I tend to think it's not that big of a deal. But sometimes they do decline, so you got to watch them.
All right, one more email. We'll take a break. Then we'll go to the phones. Lines are loaded. When you hear somebody hang up during the show, that's a good time to call 800-348-2551. This one's from SB. SB says, this is Samantha. I'm sorry. If I could read, I could tell you your name. It's Samantha. What are your recommendations regarding use of relatively thick straw layer as mulch for controlling weeds and plant diseases? Advantages, disadvantages, and that is from Samantha.
Straw is a good mulch as long as it's clean. You want to get straw that's been harvested before it's gone to seed, because if it's rye straw or wheat straw or whatever it is, oat straw, if you get it after harvest, it's got some seeds in there. But it's maybe you don't want to go too thick, right? Right?
Yeah, I actually really like, just like what you said, I think straw is a fantastic mulch. I'm assuming they're talking more of a vegetable garden than a perennial garden. It could work for both, but again, it tends to be more messy, I think, in a perennial garden.
Right.
But in a vegetable garden, that's my preferred mulch.
Hay is not straw. Hay
Good point.
Is different than straw.
What's the difference?
Hay is dried grass like you'd feed to a horse.
Yeah.
And if you put hay down as a mulch, you're going to have a hay field.
1,000 seeds. That's the difference.
Okay.
Seeds and seeds.
1,000 weed seeds versus virtually no weed seeds. And when straw breaks down, it's different than hay, too. It actually gets really black and it turns really organic. And it's a great way to, you don't have to really clean it up. You can kind of leave it in the garden.
Till it in.
Kind of roll, exactly work it in or just leave it alone. It'll rot in.
Let's take a quick break. It's Gardening Today. Fred Breglia of Landis Arboretum at Bob Graves of Fadigan's Nursery. We'll hit the phones in a moment at 800-348-2551. Vox Pop on WAMC Gardening Today with Bob Graves and Fred Breglia. And to the phones we go at 800-348-2551. Billy in Lee, Massachusetts. Billy.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I have a butterfly bush that I planted about 5 years ago. It's in a raised bed above ground. It drains well. The thing never blossoms, and I don't know what to do about it.
Oh. Well, it might have something to do with, do you ever prune it? Do you ever cut it at all?
I do. Every fall, I cut it right back down to the ground, about 6 inches above the ground.
Okay.
And then it grows like crazy.
Yep. That may be part of the problem. The general rule for the butterfly bushes, the way we generally recommend pruning them is leave them through the winter. And then in the springtime, go out there and scratch the wood, and the tips of the branches kind of start working your way from the tips to the ground, and just scratch them. And if you see green, leave them alone. And eventually you're going to see like brown, 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 and then just keep going down. You'll see green. Once you see green, stop there, and you make the pruning cut pretty much kind of like right a little into the green, but out, beyond the brown. But you could leave all the rest of the stalks, generally.
Wait till spring.
So you don't cut it to the ground.
You don't need to cut them to the ground unless the winter kills them to the ground. The butterfly bush is a plant that will actually grow like probably seven, eight feet tall and 6, 7, 8 feet wide, and it never dies to the ground if it's in the right zone. But in our zone, we don't have that privilege. We actually have to look at it each year and assess how much of it's dead. On a really hard winter, you'll lose all of it to the ground, and then you cut it all out, and then you have a new plant. But it should bloom as long as you're, you know, doing those cuts in the springtime, you might want to make sure you're at more sun than shade.
A shrub like that sometimes suffers in a raised bed, too, because it's above grade.
True.
And the soil gets colder. So if it continues to give you a problem, you'll want to try putting it right in the ground and then mulching it well.
That's a good point.
So I thought it had to be in above ground.
Nope.
No, they do. They do best in the ground around here for sure.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah. All right, Billy. Thank you very much for the call. Bess in Walford. Bess, you're on.
Hi. How are you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
You betcha.
So at this point in my vegetable garden with raised beds, we've harvested sugar snap peas, snow peas, garlic, and we have some empty space. We have a growing, obviously, the stuff that's growing now, tomatoes, eggplants, beans, squashes. But I'm sort of stumped by what to plant now that is going to be able to tolerate the heat and will be able to grow in this short growing season.
Well, sometimes you might even want to wait just a little bit to put in some of the cold weather crops. You're right. Peas, beans, things of that sort will grow pretty good. Radishes, spinach, lettuce, as it cools off. I think maybe a little late for things like broccoli, and you might be able to do broccoli.
You might be able to get away with it. Broccoli, cauliflower probably would go.
Cauliflower. Some of those plants that are going to grow longer.
And it's beets, if we didn't name that. Carrots could also work. Carrots. Potential.
Yep.
You still have time.
So a lot of the root vegetables?
Yeah.
According to my wife, you still got a lot of time. She's listening.
All right, Bess.
And before you go, I'm going to sneak in another one if I can. We've got cauliflower growing, but so far it's all leaves, and the leaves are really, really big, and there's nothing forming like that vegetable. What's going on?
They don't like this weather. You know, we got to have some heat. Let's get you know, it was warm early, but now it's been kind of rainy and cool for a while, and I think I just wait and see. There's nothing you're going to do that's going to make a difference. It's weather related at this point.
For sure.
Yeah.
It may end up working out for you though. Just sometimes it just takes a little longer with the weather, the environmental conditions.
Bess, thanks very much for the call. It's Gardening Today with Fred Breglia at Bob Graves, 800-348-2551. The number. Jack is in Pittsfield. Jack, you're on.
Hi. I have two questions. I have irises, daylilies, and hostas, and I want to know what to do after they've gone past. And the second question I have raspberry plants overtaking my property, and I want them gone, but I'd like to do it in an environmentally conscious way.
Okay.
Well, the raspberries, basically, you dig them out.
Yep.
I mean, that's going to be the right way to do it. Cutting them isn't going to do it.
No, not unless you could keep mowing them or, you know, keep cutting them. That would wear them down. But otherwise, digging them out, and if they seem to be producing fruit, I mean, a lot of people would probably take them.
Yeah.
You might even be able to find somebody that'll just come in and dig some out.
Yeah.
A neighbor or something like that. So
on the perennials, you know, as they deteriorate and start to look poorly, you cut them back. You can divide them later in the season, a little early right now, but in August, September, if you wanted to divide them, if they're starting to get tight and too many of them in there. But basically, with perennials, they start to look bad, cut them back.
Yep, wait till they yellow out and then cut them back. And like if you did want to divide them, like Bob said, you know, August is a good month for that. So we're coming into time to move them around.
Jack, thank you very much for the call. Gardening Today, it's Bob Graves and Fred Breglia here to answer your questions. Madeline in Rhinebeck. Madeline, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've solved the problem, but I'm just curious. Is it possible to get woolly adelgid on something other than a hemlock? I have a white Japanese pine that seemed to have it. It looked exactly like it. And I sprayed it with neem, and that seemed to work. But I thought they were just particular to hemlock.
Yeah, it's not going to be the hemlock woolly adelgid. It's actually probably going to be one of two things. With pine, sometimes you see tons of white on them. And I'm assuming these white is on the top of your pine, not underneath like it would be on the hemlock, right? You're seeing the white more on top or bottom, kind of all around, kind of obvious. Or not so?
It's when you look at the branch, it's on the bottom, and it's at the intersections where the twigs meet the little branch.
That sounds like mealybug or woolly aphid, doesn't it?
Yeah, there's a few of them. It could be a cottony scale.
Could be the woolly aphid.
Yes. It could be a mealybug. It could also be resin glands on pine. And pines, a lot of times you'll see it. You probably see it a lot in the nursery with them, on the mugos especially. They have these little white things sometimes all over them, and they're actually just dried resin, like dried pitch.
If it's fuzzy, it's not. If it's a little hard,
it is white and fuzzy.
Fuzzy, yeah, it's probably an insect.
Yeah, it sounds like more insect. So then probably a scale, a mealybug, or a.
It'd be a woolly aphid.
Or a woolly aphid.
But your neem would be a good thing to use. Yep. It's a contact killer. It suffocates them. That would be a good thing to use.
But not the hemlock woolly adelgid.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Madeline. We appreciate the call. Gardening Today on Vox Pop. Beth is in Kinderhook. Beth, you're on.
Hello.
Hello.
I have a Shademaster locust tree that appears to be infected with mimosa webworms. What can I do about that?
Okay. So you have nests in the trees right now and tons of caterpillars in there?
I haven't seen the caterpillars as yet, but the leaves are starting to turn brown towards the top. And last year this happened, and then I did see webs and caterpillars. They're pretty small, but they would hang from their threads, and it kind of decimated the foliage on the tree. Looked kind of lousy. I was hoping that maybe it would be cold enough this past winter to kill them, but it doesn't seem that that was the case.
Yeah. Insects usually survive the winter pretty well. At this point in time, you know, there's a question. Certainly you could get somebody to spray it, or you could do it yourself. It's fairly easy to control those. But at the same time, it's not doing all that much damage at this point. Most of the plant's growing and energy storage has already happened. It looks lousy, but it's probably not going to be a real problem. You think, Fred?
Yeah, I think I would agree with you. A lot of the times, you know, people are, you know, they see a defoliation occur. And, you know, we see that a lot with a lot of caterpillars this year. And those defoliations get scary, and especially when, like, most of your trees getting defoliated, because now we're starting to enter into a stressed situation. But all of those trees, as long as they're, you know, not an underlying condition, are almost all going to be coming back. At the Arboretum, we rarely treat for things unless they're really going to be detrimental to the health of the plant long term. And, you know, we have yet to spray anything in this entire season.
Yeah, I was reluctant to use spray for a variety of reasons.
Yeah, okay, just let it go.
So a lot of times if you can reach the nests, you know, we do aesthetically remove some of them, kind of get a pair of work gloves on and just kind of grab the nest and squash it up. If you can reach them, it works real well on, like, ornamental fruit trees on a honey locust that's getting big. You know, you're probably not going to be able to really get in there much.
Yeah, it's big.
But as long as
about 30 or 40 feet, and I seem to start at the top.
Yep. So as long as the tree looks healthy, I'd say you're all right for a while.
Okay.
If it starts to look like it's really defoliating it, you could follow up with me if you wanted to on my email, fred@landisarboretum.org, and I can go over some other options with you.
So it's fred@landisarboretum.org. Thank you very much for the call. And now we go to Kelly in Addison, Vermont. Hello, Kelly.
Hi. I have a young apple tree that I just planted. It's about 6 feet tall. And I came out 2 days ago in the morning and found the bark had been stripped on the bottom.
Had been at the very
I'm wondering if it's going to live.
At the very bottom? Is it like
No, it didn't go all the way around. There's a big, long strip that was taken off by a, you know, a critter.
Yeah, it could have been a deer rubbing it. Could have been a rabbit.
I don't live with deer. I do have woodchucks and bunnies, though.
Yeah,
could
bunnies,
have been a rabbit.
Bunnies will do it.
So first thing you want to do is put a sort of a guard around it. You could buy like a tree guard. Tree wrap would suffice. If you had some hardware cloth, screening, you could make your own. Something that has, you know, holes that are small enough for the critter to not be able to enter it. And, you know, a lot of times I get these calls because bark gets stripped on trees a lot of times, whether it's a critter, whether it's a mower, a lot of times with mowers.
Yeah.
And, you know, people get really scared because it looks like a really bad injury. But actually, when you look at the what happens to that injury as time goes on, the pruning cut, we don't have any time to get into this lengthy conversation, but which I'd love to do, but if you do a pruning cut, you're actually severing in massive amounts of vessels, transport vessels. And the pruning cut actually is probably one of the worst injuries you can do to you know, to a tree or shrub, yet we think nothing of that. And that doesn't mean don't prune. Pruning's good, but it can be bad. But you're introducing a lot more of a bigger cut And that one takes a lot more to kind of close up.
Yeah, with this type of thing, if the majority, what they did is they ate some of the plumbing. They ate some of the pipes. And if there's most of the pipes left, if they didn't go all the way around, it'd probably be fine. When they go all the way around, that's not good.
That's not good because it's cutting your vascular tissue off.
But there's basically nothing you can do about it except what Fred said is protect it from further damage.
Yep. But the good news is that internally, that will actually be a lot less. And once it closes over and you prevent any more injury, it'll be a less of an injury to the tree than a pruning cut.
Yep.
Most likely.
Okay.
You might be okay.
Thank you. You'll
probably be all right.
Kelly, thanks a lot. All right, let's grab a few more here before the next break, and it looks like it's Katie's turn. Katie in Ballston Lake. Katie.
Hi. My question is about Asian jumping worms. I'm pretty sure that I have them in my compost piles, before I was positive that that's what they were, I spread some of the compost on shrubs and on the lawn. And I guess my question is, given that they're in there, should I stop using that compost, or I'm just not sure what to do?
Well, first off, the earthworms in general are not really native, so they've been brought in, a lot of different species. I don't think there's any native earthworm. I don't think there could
really?
Be. All the ones you use for fishing have been brought in.
You're kidding me.
So they're everywhere, yeah. So the ones that I've been getting for like night crawlers, those are definitely imports.
Wow.
Now, the Asian jumping worm is a bigger decomposer than most of the other worms, which is why it's a problem. It starts to break down the organic matter a little too fast. So is it an issue? It certainly can be. Is it an issue in your garden? I don't think it's going to be. It's a much bigger problem in the woodlands because it's breaking down the natural decomposition a little quicker than the average rate of our forests. So when they get into heavy populations in woodlands, I tend to think the impact will be larger. In a garden, you know, I don't think it's going to be a big of a factor. I think
there's not much you can do about it, but you can continue to add organic material.
That's what I was saying.
They are breaking it down fast, but you know, maybe at the point is you do want to use your compost.
Correct. I actually would agree with that. We may have those at our home as well. We have some pretty feisty worms that work real well for fishing, and but we also have a lot of compost, so we like to think we're keeping ahead of the jumping worms at our house. So I think it's okay to use it if your compost pile's heating up to the right temperature, which may be part of the problem. If it's not big enough and it's not going to heat up enough, but if it heats up enough, it will get rid of a lot of those critters. So you might want to look up some of the basics in terms of the sizes that are needed of compost piles to heat the internals to the right temperatures.
Yeah.
If you want more composting info, I do have a really great fact sheet I could email you. The same email there, fred@landisarboretum.org. It just gives you the general, do's, don'ts, and specific sizes.
Okay. So that's pretty much what I've read, that they can be really destructive in forests. But
that's right.
I hadn't read anything about, in lawns or, trees or the shrubs around your house or whatever. They do break down compost really, really fast. We've noticed a big change in how fast our kitchen waste is getting composted.
Okay.
And the other interesting thing is that there used to be these jumping worms and then, smaller ones that were maybe red wigglers. I'm not sure. All of the other worms are gone now. There's just no worms in there except the jumping worms. So I don't know what that is, but yeah.
Interesting.
But anyway, I'm glad to hear that.
I was going to say, it may be an opportunistic. The jumping worms are kind of over competing, with the other species.
Yeah.
So they may have less of an ability to be able to keep living and thriving, is my guess.
Katie, thanks a lot. How high do they jump?
They don't jump that high, but
what
they do, when you put one in your hand, boy, they are just... it's hard to hold it in your hand. If you ever use like fishing worms and you can usually, thread
really
a hook, these guys are like, they're pretty wild.
Yeah.
But that being said, if you hook them well, they work really well for fishing.
They wriggle around and
they're great
catch
for
a nice
trout
bass.
Stream,
trout, good for you.
For most part, yeah.
Terrific. All right. Well, enough about fishing. Let's take a break. 800-348-2551 is our number. It's a Gardening Today, et cetera, with Fred Reglia and Bob Graves. We'll be back. Thank you. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. Gardening today with Fred Breglia at Bob Graves. And Fred, we do have some native worms here in this country, right?
We do. It looks like a lot of the earthworms, a lot of the night crawlers and those types are mostly incidentally introduced from Europe. They've been, looks like, around here for quite a while.
Okay.
Naturalized quite well. The honeybee is another one that's not native that a lot of people think is.
So. I'll be darned. This email from Jim. When is the best time to cut back a burning bush? Why are you laughing, Bob Graves?
They take pruning pretty well. You know, the rule of thumb I like, and Fred's going to add to this, but the rule of thumb I like is to prune something when it's in a period of growth but not most active growth. So not in April, May, June maybe. You can do it this time of year. It's a little harder because when it's got leaves on, you can't see it as well. But if you were to say the best time, Fred, what would you say?
You know, I think you've covered it, Bob. It's like you really, you know, with the burning bush, it's not one that, you know, we recommend planting at this point because it's becoming an, it is an invasive. It's listed as an invasive for New York and a lot of other states as well. But if, because a lot of these invasives are really tough, you know, I've never had a problem really, you know, doing too much with burning bushes over the years of landscape
maintenance. Them.
I've really
butchered them, and they come back.
They do. I've actually, my early years of pruning, I could say I learned a lot of what not to do on burning bush. The one thing they don't like is like a lilac, you can rejuvenate right to the ground, and you can also do that with rhododendrons and azaleas and a lot of other plants, but burning bush don't like to be rejuvenated like that. Other than that, they
trim the branches, not the main stem.
That's right. Yeah.
This one's from Aaron in Greenfield, Massachusetts. Can you talk briefly, about the importance of cultivating native plant species on the local ecosystem?
Oh, that's a great idea.
So she wants to know about sources for native plants?
Aaron says, can you talk briefly about the importance of cultivating native plants on the local ecosystem?
Okay, well, you know, native plants are super great. There's a huge push for native plants for a lot of reasons. You know, when we start to tie it into ecological reasons, then we start to bring in the pollinators.
Yeah.
The pollinators are huge now. And
I think that's one of the main things people are trying to do is you know, plant things that naturally would grow that we've kind of crowded out or mowed down.
Yep.
Because the pollinators need them.
They
need variety. They don't want a monoculture.
That's it. And we talk about like the honeybee, which is not native, but it's a great pollinator. That guy is a generalist. He tends to pollinate all kinds of plants and all kinds of species, which is why it's so well. Our native bees, we have so many native bees, but they're often very much more specific. They pollinate certain things. So if we don't have those kinds of native plants in the ecosystem, then we actually lose the pollinators that sort of co-evolved with those plants. We have a lot of co-evolution with plants and pollinators, and if we start to lose that diversity, we really have a problem. When you combine that with invasives, you know, we have emerald ash borer coming through and wiping out ash everywhere.
Yeah.
And what's coming up behind those ash? Well, in some places, it's nothing but Pyrus caloriana or calorie pear. Not around here, thank God, but in other states. And that means basically no biodiversity, which means that, you know, any of the pollinators that were there with the ash and all the other plants, now we're losing all of those species. So, you know, I can't say enough good things about natives.
You really see the problem of a monoculture now as you drive around because all the ash trees are dying and some of the oaks are having trouble and the sugar maples are having trouble. And so, you know, there's a lot of the towns have specified over the years, you got to plant this, you got to plant that, you got to plant something else. And that's not the way to do it.
No, it's not. You want to, you know, the big push right now is really managing landscapes for a lot of the biological controls. And those biological controls are often everything from birds to other insects. You really want to look at it as a whole system. And the way that the landscapes are growing in the future here is all moving that direction to, you know, not just monocultured, like Bob said, not just planting pretty flowers. It's okay to bring things that are not native in because they also have a good role. But you know, when you bring in just exotics, you're not really benefiting the pollinators on a bigger picture, especially the native stuff that we're trying to preserve.
Let's jump back to the phones here at 800-348-2551. Maureen, you're in Albany. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a huge lilac tree that needs to be pruned, and I'm wondering if it's too late to do that now.
Well, no. The answer to that is it's not too late. You might take away some of the flowers by pruning it right now. The best time is prune it right after it blooms. energies go into next year's flower buds pretty much right after that in seed production. So,
but all it does is eliminate some flowers. Mm-hmm. It doesn't hurt the plant. And I think Fred would agree, you want to head it back, trim it down some, but you also want to take some of those bigger, older stems right down to the ground, because that will help to rejuvenate it and keep new growth coming.
All right. Thank you so much.
Maureen, thank you so much. And Penny is in Saratoga. Penny.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Where the end of your garden meets the end of the lawn, what is the best way to separate them? create an edge, or what do you do to help prevent the transference of weeds?
You know, I don't like edging. I don't like bricks. I don't like plastic. Okay. I don't like wood.
Why don't you like bricks?
Because it doesn't last. You have to redo it. You know, when you an edge of a bed, really what you do is go in there with a tool every year or two and you recut the edge. And because the grass is, you know, the grass is going to grow over to brick, it's going to grow over to plastic, it's going to grow over anything you put there.
Yeah.
So we don't use it much. We just recut that edge because the grass is going to continue to try to get in.
100%. Yeah, I don't like edging either. You know, some people like it. It's okay. It's aesthetics, but it doesn't have the real clean, crisp edge that you're looking for. And the way to get that is just what Bob said. It's just you use a spade. You go in and you cut a nice straight edge. There's probably demos, I'm sure, online, or if you look at it.
It's not the easiest thing to do, right? But we actually take a grinder and sharpen our spade so it's like a knife.
I do too.
And it makes it a lot easier.
Oh.
Yikes.
Yep.
And then do you go down straight or on an angle?
Either way. Yeah.
Either way. I like to go straight down and then do a back cut on an angle so it has the edge slightly like dug deeper than the lawn around it, and then when you put a mulch in, if you're going to put a mulch in, it generally stays a little bit lower than the grass line. So when you mow, and Bob will probably agree with this, when you mow, you can put that mower deck
right
along
the
edge. And you don't have to worry about it sucking up the mulch or making a mess. It saves you a lot with string trimming too.
Yeah. Okay, and how deep should it go?
2-3 inches.
Maybe 4 at the most.
Okay.
2-3 inches sounds
okay, great. Gee, thank you so much.
You got it.
Thanks, Penny. It's the Gardening Show today with Fred Breglia of Landis Arboretum and Bob Graves of Fatigan's Nursery and Jim in Adams, Massachusetts. Jim, you're on.
Hey, great. Thank you for taking my call. I'm driving hands-free, but I'm pulling over because I get a lot of road noise. Okay,
fair enough.
We're safe. Yes, I recently discovered a small wild blackberry bush growing in on a riverbank, which is in my backyard, and I'd like it's mostly in shade. I know that they don't like that. I'd like to know how to foster it and make it spread. Is it transplantable? Wild blackberries. What do I do to make them to foster them?
Well, it's a pretty easy thing to transplant. I don't know that I'd do it right now. I would be inclined to wait till later in the season. You don't like to take things that have leaves. You know, a deciduous plant, you don't want to really move it when it has leaves on it. So it would be, late October or November.
It's fruiting now.
You can prune it back a little bit when you do it because they grow pretty vigorously and get it out into some sunshine, but it's not hard to move.
Okay, great. It's very small right now. It's only about 18-20 inches, but it was sending up a huge tall shoot, which I cut back. It had like a 4-foot long shoot right in the center. I cut that back.
Sounds good.
Thank you, Jim. And let's see who has been. Oh, looks like Patty in East Greenbush. You've been waiting a while. Patty, go ahead.
That's okay. It's well worth it. Two quick questions. My first one was about pruning and fertilizing. I've got basically a yard full of perennial shrubs like the burning bushes, but also rhododendrons, azaleas, japonicas, I think, and hollies. Is now an okay time to prune or fertilize, or do I wait? And then the other question was about go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, it's kind of the same answer we had before with the lilac. If you prune now, you may lose some flowers. You can do it. You're going to take off some flower buds. You can fertilize now, but if you're going to do it, I think, Fred, I'd do it fairly soon, wouldn't you?
I would. You could wait till fall. You could wait till the leaves also are like mostly off your plant. If you're going to do it now, just like Bob said, I'd do it soon, but I'd also maybe do it a little lighter than the recommendation on the bag. Fall is a great time after the leaves drop. Spring prior to growth, you know, another great time.
We don't fertilize a lot in, you know, from mid-August to maybe the end of October because you don't want to push new growth at that point, which may be a little soft going into the winter. So do it now, early spring, as Fred says, or later in the fall.
Okay, and then just real quick, you got me interested with the native. How do I find out what are native species for this area?
You got a lot of different things. There's a lot of printed material. If you're looking for woody plants, there's like a checklist by Mitchell, which is a really great book, New York Native Plants.
I'm sure Department of Environmental Conservation has stuff online about that, too.
They definitely would. There's a lot of info out
there.
Or
Cornell.
Just make sure it's from reputable sources because the internet is a great thing to use, but boy, oh boy, it's dangerous when you
right.
look something up and you know the answer and you see some of these people that are telling you these are the right answers and it's really, really wrong. But the good news is that if you get it from a reputable source like a university or DEC, you could take that to the bank.
So, for instance, Japanese knotweed, not necessarily native.
That's not native, but it's native somewhere.
Well, you make a point. Let's go to Layla in Mount Tremper. Layla, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I got kind of inspired by the comments about respecting native plants and things. I have just a shout out to all the people who've fled the cities to come out, live out in the country. Please pay attention to where you've moved and please don't make it into the city. Please respect the biodiversity, learn of what you've moved into, and partner with the earth that you've moved to rather than just moving up here because you're running out of the city. You know, we all need to live together here. Hmm. And then the second thing was a question. I picked dozens of little darling slugs out of my garden the other morning. We've had so much rain. And I was curious about what positive function they serve in nature. They've got to because nature's efficient. You know, slugs don't exist just to annoy gardeners.
Sure.
So what's their positive when they're in balance? What's their positive function that you know of?
Well, they're a food source for other critters. There are things that will eat slugs.
Who'll eat a slug?
Well, you get, I think, some of your reptiles or amphibians that are living in that same area, birds, if they can find them. But they're just
eat Japanese beetles. Would eat Japanese beetles, they would love them. But slugs, they absolutely wouldn't look at them.
Yeah.
Mm. But maybe other birds?
They're also, I think other birds. But I also think that they're breaking down a lot of stuff. I know they're racing me to get mushrooms.
They like them too, huh?
Oh, my God, they are.
The mushrooms you brought, there were no slugs on those, right?
No.
Okay, because I, you know, otherwise you take them home, right?
No, there's no slugs on those.
Those were slugs.
but they have a role, and they, you know, a lot of times they're breaking things down, and they're part of the food web, so they have a good thing. They're just a pain in the neck when they get in the garden.
Hey, Layla, thank you.
I have noticed that they were on the potato plants that weren't doing well, and it sort of like seemed like they only go to the things that are weaker, which is kind of a good function.
Well, that's very true of a lot of insects and critters, that they can detect that plants are having a problem.
A little weaker. Thanks for the call. Now let's go to Cheshire, Massachusetts. Shelley, you're on. Hello. Hello.
Hi.
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 I have, this is the first time it happened. I had a camperdown elm tree growing. And I wasn't here during the winter, and my neighbor sent me a picture of a porcupine in the tree. And when I came back up in the spring, it had eaten all the bark on the limbs of the tree.
Yeah.
And I thought, I mean, it was a very beautiful picture if you love modern art, but I looked at it and I thought that my tree was a loser. It was going to be gone. But actually, much to my surprise, the leaves started to come back out again. It's not all in leaf right now. I would say there's 80% of it is leafed out. And I just wonder how do I keep porcupines away?
Yeah.
And B, is there anything that would repel them? Or is this dangerous? I don't think they're going to be able to find bark on it again in the spring.
I have a terrible porcupine problem at my house.
Really?
And their favorite fruit is hemlock. And they get up in the
like
trees
hemlock.
And they can just destroy even a, you know, a 60 or 70 foot hemlock.
They climb trees.
Oh,
I didn't know.
Way
this.
Climb
You're
trees.
Kidding me.
They live in trees.
And they got into my Japanese
big
maple
hollow trees.
And ate the bark on that. And what I spray a repellent, you know, there are some commercial preparations, pepper, dried blood, garlic, but all you have to do is discourage them a little bit because they eat almost any bark. So a spray repellent on that would do you a lot.
Wow.
Yep. You might be able to fence it.
How often would you put it on?
Well, it depends. In the wintertime, it lasts a little longer than it does when it's raining like this. But I do it about once a month.
But, I mean, for Bob, if the tree is 60 feet tall, what are you going to spray blood up
to
the top of
a
60-foot tree?
This is a smaller tree.
Oh, I see.
Here,
okay.
That she's talking about.
Yeah, this is a very small tree.
Yep,
yeah.
And even on a big tree, though, they're not unless he's living in that big tree, he's moving on the ground and going up it.
Yeah,
so,
he's not living
so
up
you
there.
Spray
he lives
all
under
around
the
base of that big guy. Yeah,
I know where he lives.
Okay, all right, fair enough. We've got him at the Arboretum. I mean, we, you know, they live in balance over there. There's enough room to...
Yeah.
To socially distance with those guys.
Very cool. That's a great call. I don't think we've had a porcupine
no,
call on
this
show.
No, we usually get a lot of animals, but not porcupines.
They're very interesting critters.
Really?
Very
they are
interesting.
Cool.
Do you ever talk to them?
I don't talk to them, but I tell you, they're a lot faster than you think they are.
Really?
They're
pretty
quick.
Good eating, too, from what I hear.
Yeah, I didn't do that.
Did
yet.
You just...
We got to go there with the mushrooms. They're good with mushrooms.
Did you just say they're good eating?
they're considered good in some circles.
Really?
Oh, Fred, every time.
You move in strange
every
circles, my
could.
Friend. Tom in Sharon Springs. Tom, you're on.
Yeah, hi. I wanted some information on the Rhizosphera. I have some nice spruces and a Norway spruce. It seems like they're in a couple years now of decline. They're not dead. Still have some bottom branches left. You know, it's not too bad yet. I've been... spraying with the chlorothalonil,
yeah.
And how long will it take, or will that work, and will they come back?
Now, the timing on chlorothalonil is really important. You got to do it in the spring when the buds are breaking. What you're talking about, colloquially, we call needle cast, which isn't as bad on Norways, I don't think, as it is on Colorados and Doug firs and white firs and things like that. But it's a very destructive disease.
It is. It's to the point where we really don't recommend planting any of the Colorado spruce at all, pretty much anymore. But the good thing is that we don't recommend spraying too often. But there are times to spray, and if you want to keep your blue spruce and any of those other spruce that are really got that needle cast, you're not going to be able to probably keep them alive by just pruning dead branches out. You're eventually going to lose the plant. So spraying is the solution if you have a big one. If you're trying to preserve it and it's still relatively healthy, that means it has a good shot of reproducing needles. It won't grow new needles on dead branches, but it will on ones that are declining if you can stop it.
All right, we have to leave it there, I'm afraid. Hey, Bob Graves, how do people find Fadigan's Nursery on the web and in person?
We're at 1140 Troy Schenectady Road, near the Airport Road. That's Route 7 that runs between Schenectady and Troy. And Fadigan's.com is our website, which has lots of information on it.
Fred Breglia, how do we find the Landis Arboretum?
All right, we're at 174 Lape Road in Esperance, New York, and you can go to our website, www.landisarboretum.org.
Well, thank you both. We will talk to you guys in a couple of weeks. Support comes from Ambrose Electric Standby Power, an electrical contractor providing sales, service, and installation of residential and commercial Generac automatic standby generators serving the Greater Capital District for over 40 years. AmbroseLEC.com. And the Lake George Land Conservancy, Bolton Landing, New York, protecting the forests, wetlands, shorelines, and ridges that protect Lake George permanently. Projects, events, and news at lglc.org. Once again, thanks to Fred Breglia and Bob Graves for joining us today. Thank you for listening. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Susie Chekai took the calls. I'm Ray Graff. We will have an interesting show tomorrow. Do you often think about pizza and whiskey together? Most people, aside from me, do not. I do, and we're going to have a show with the folks from Albany Distilling and the Fazio's Pizza, and we'll see how it goes. You might want to have some antacid handy. It may be tough to bear, but that's tomorrow at 2 p.m. We'll see you then. Stand by now for the Capital Connection.